Hello, podcast listeners. This is your host, Brian. I'm RBW King, back with another episode of, with a new podcast episode, even though it's been about a few weeks, but I've been busy. Not just with my job at Longhorn, but everywhere else. Basically, I was shopping at my old job yesterday, at Meijer, a job that I quit because they kept fucking me over. So I went shopping and got some things. Got some alcohol, like the Mike's Hard Lemonade, one of my preferred choices of alcoholic drinks, and it's one of the only alcoholic drinks I can actually tolerate without throwing up. But I did pick up a book, and not just one, but two. I picked up one on Jack the Ripper, and I also picked up one called Peril, which has to do with the Trump and with the Trump squatting and the Biden presidency. Bob Woodward criticizes both. Of course, Trump receives as much criticism as he can get, and Biden deserves a little bit of criticism, only for a couple things. The only three good things he's done so far was he signed a 30-day extension so that the highway workers wouldn't be furloughed to other places, and then he signed a bill the other day averting a government shutdown. And then he also pulled the Taliban people, and then he also pulled on the troops out of Afghanistan. Those are the only three good things he's done so far. He's been trying to get an infrastructure deal passed, but, you know, the Republicans, they've been standing in the way and trying to do everything they can to make sure he doesn't get his agenda done that he wants. But that's that. I started watching a show called Criminal Minds on Netflix. Now, for me, I don't actually have cable, but I have a Roku stick. And so I can watch Netflix through my Roku stick. I also have it through my Blu-ray player, so I can watch Netflix on either one. But I technically watch Netflix through my Roku. And so I started watching Criminal Minds. I only started watching it, 2 days ago. And it might have been 3 days, 3 or 4 days ago, actually. And I've gotten through, and I got up to season 2 already in 4 days. I watch about 6 or 7 episodes of a show a day when I'm not working, and that helps me out to build it up a lot faster. My only bitch complaint, though, is that with the show, there was 15 seasons, but on Netflix they only have 12, and they're missing the other 3. So I guess I deal with seasons 1 through 12, and then if they put seasons 13, 14, and 15 in, I would be happy to see those myself. I'm also waiting on them to finish up season 11 of The Walking Dead, and when they put that in, I'm going to watch that too. I also basketball season is going to be starting, and I think the preseason is, I think, starts this week, but the regular season starts within the next month or so. So I'm excited about that. I'm still waiting on college basketball season to start too. And then I can't wait to see how my college team does this year. Now, one thing I do want to get to is on this. And even though this article was from 3 days ago, I'm going to probably do a video on it for my YouTube channel. But just to throw it out there, this is what the article says. Biden basically has more willpower to basically to abolish the filibuster than he's been willing to use. Now, a majority of Democrats oppose the Senate filibuster, and it's still not entirely clear whether the current president, Joe Biden, is among them. In March, when asked whether he would call for changes to the Senate 60-vote threshold for legislation, Biden replied that the only thing I've been relatively good at in his long career in the Senate is figuring out when to move and when not to move, and you got to have all the votes, which is true. 6 months later, Biden may or may not have the votes, and now it is time to move. As the Senate parliamentarian has made clear, many of the largest parts of the Biden agenda, including his comprehensive immigration reform, gun safety legislation, and those will never pass as long as the Senate is at a 50-vote threshold, remains in place. But neither will the Freedom to Vote Act, Congress's last hope to expand voting rights and protect the free and fair elections. In a best-case scenario, the filibuster will render Democrats unable to deliver on their campaign promises, despite controlling both houses of Congress and the White House. But in a worst-case scenario, the filibuster will doom democracy itself. Senators are an ornery bunch, but they don't like the White House telling them how to run the chamber. But this White House no longer has a choice. Biden's decision on whether and how to involve himself in the fight over the Senate's rules will likely define how his presidency goes. Fortunately for Biden, Biden is not the first chief executive to face this challenge. More than a century ago, a president back then publicly attacked the filibuster as an existential threat, and not just to his agenda, but to the country in itself. The circumstances that led to his decision and the consequences that followed carry lessons from reformers today, and they suggest that Biden might be wise to make a big public case against the filibuster now. The first filibuster was launched back in 1837, and it bore little resemblance to what's employed by Moscow Mitch and his fellow Republicans today. Obstructionist senators had to be physically present in the chamber. If they lost control of the floor, the filibuster was done, so long as the floor was held, there was no way for a supermajority of senators to force a vote on a bill. And while a single lawmaker might struggle to sustain a filibuster, a handful of lawmakers could round robin speaking privileges indefinitely, holding up nearly any piece of legislation for nearly any length of time. From the filibuster's earliest days, some senators tried to eliminate it. The most notable of these was Henry Clay, the great compromiser, who apparently did not think that the filibuster was conducive to great compromise. But because any attempt to reform the filibuster could itself be filibustered, the would-be reformers learned to live with it instead. And this proved to be a lot easier than some 19th century senators that might have predicted. The lawmakers amended the unanimous consent agreement, which made filibustering less likely. In those days, the Capitol had no air conditioning, and it was lit with stinky beef tallow candles, providing a strong incentive for obstructionists to surrender the floor. But most of all, the 19th century Senate had far less to do back then. In 1837, the Senate took a break from March 10th to September 4th, and another break from October 16th to December 4th, and it remained in session until July of 1838. And then they once again adjourned until December. With so few items on the agenda back then, filibusters could frequently waste weeks or even months without much consequence, and while their obstruction might have shortened a recess, there would still be time to spare for top legislative priorities. Following the Civil War, however, America's lawmakers got much busier. The federal government took on more responsibilities, the country's global reach expanded, and thanks in part to new technologies, the world began moving a lot faster than what people could expect. Then comes 1917. A 19th century Senate collided with the 20th century world. German submarines had been sinking American merchant ships trading with Britain, and the current president then, the president that was current back then, was President Woodrow Wilson, and he asked Congress to arm those ships to ward off future attacks. The House easily passed Wilson's request, but 11 senators, correctly fearing that such a move would bring America closer to World War I, successfully filibustered that measure. For 80 years, presidents and lawmakers had mostly been able to bargain with or to outlast the Senate obstructionists. But this was different. The filibuster was now a life-and-death matter for American sailors and travelers. It put the country's national security at risk, and for Wilson, the only political scientist ever elected president, the danger was even greater. The Senate's rule threatened to turn America's defining strength and its system of self-government into an Achilles' heel. The United States could be a great nation in a new century, but it could be the home of the Senate filibuster. But in Wilson's estimation, it cannot be both. Wilson could have shared these views with senators in private and negotiated behind closed doors on a plan for reform, but instead, on March 4th, 1917, just hours after being sworn in for a second term, Wilson issued a blistering, what they call public statement, which ran the following day in the New York Times. Congress has been unable to either safeguard the country or to vindicate the elementary rights of its citizens, he wrote. He listed examples of the Senate obstruction behind the merchant ship bill, a scuttled trade bill and a mining bill, a water rights bill that had left America less able to compete in the 20th century. Finally, he reached his conclusion here. A little group of willful men, representing no opinion but their own, have rendered the great government of the United States helpless and contemptible. The remedy? There is but one. The only remedy is that the rules of the Senate have to be altered so that it can fucking act. With public opinion on his side as America prepared for war, Wilson and his allies came close to finding enough Senate votes to eliminate the filibuster altogether, but in the end, they were forced to come up to a compromise. A simple majority would still not be enough to end a debate, but a two-thirds majority would. A little group of willful men could no longer grind America to a halt. The Pulse-Wilson filibuster continued to hamstring the country in tragic ways. Segregationists used it to defeat anti-lynching legislation and preserve the Jim Crow law for nearly 50 years. But from 1917 to the 1970s, when the filibuster was reformed yet again, America greatly benefited from Wilson's well-timed Wolves fight. After World War I, the United States was able to function both as a democracy and as a global power. The great domestic projects of the 20th century, Social Security and Medicare, the interstate highway system, the GI Bill, were able to move forward without the possibility that a handful of reactionaries might block them. It's also entirely possible, perhaps even likely, that the American century would not have happened without a change to the Senate rule. More than 100 years later, after Wilson denounced the filibuster, President Biden faces a different type of a challenge. Instead of a handful of willful men and women, he faces an entire party of obstructionists. At the same time, he can pass parts of his agenda, such as changing the tax code and confirming judges with just only 50 Senate votes. But with democracy itself on the line, and with the government unable to confront pressing economic and national security challenges, such as immigration, reform, and climate change, the White House faces the basic choice it faced a century ago. The Senate can keep its filibuster, or the American experiment can succeed in the years ahead. It's the same divergence of paths that Wilson had to deal with, and the right to move is the same as well. But the rules of the Senate must be altered so that it can act. But whether the Senate rules will change is ultimately up to the senators themselves, but Biden knows this, as well as anybody, that lawmakers bristle when the White House tells them what to do. But history demonstrates that with public opinion on his side. But the president has little to lose, throwing himself into the filibuster fight, and the country has a great deal to gain from that. Here's another one, too, I'm going to put on my YouTube channel for later on. Nearly 50 million senior citizens could face delays in their Social Security payments if Congress does not suspend or raise the debt ceiling in the coming weeks, the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen had told lawmakers on Thursday. It is catastrophic for the economy and for individual families, Yellen said at a House Financial Services Committee hearing. Nearly 50 million seniors could stop receiving Social Security payments, or they could have a delay in them, Yellen had said, echoing what she wrote in a Wall Street Journal op-ed earlier this month. Our troops would not know when they would get their next paycheck. We have 30 million families who rely on the monthly child tax credits, and they would not receive that relief, at least not on time anyway. Unless Congress addresses the debt limit by October 18th, the federal government will no longer be able to borrow for its operations, forcing it to limit its spending. Although the House has twice passed measures to do so, the effort is expected to fail again in the Senate, where the Republicans are united in their opposition to the bill. Just what would it mean for Americans remains uncertain, since Congress has always stepped in to raise, extend, or revise the division of the definition of the debt limit in the past. The Treasury Department could still pay some of its bills, since it would still have tax revenue coming in, but it's not known what it would decide to pay and when, experts said. The Social Security beneficiaries would be at risk for not receiving their payments for the first time since the program was created in 1935, said Max Richman, who's the CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. They are scheduled to receive $90 billion in payments in October. Some 40% of the beneficiaries depend on the monthly paychecks for at least 90% of their income, and two-thirds of recipients depend on the infusions for at least half of their income, he said. But not having a check for a few weeks or a month is devastating, Richman said. Beneficiaries are going to have to decide, do I pay my rent, do I buy my food, or do I have to buy my medicine? Also, millions of parents who are set to receive 3 more monthly installments of the enhanced child tax credit this year may also have to wait for the refunds if there is a default. The Internal Revenue Service is scheduled to send approximately $15 billion in payments on the 15th of each month, and many families are depending on the money to buy food and necessary items for their children, but parents receive up to $300 for each child that's six years old up to the age of 17. Meanwhile, more than 42.3 million Americans who receive food stamps, which are basically Trump supporters, could be left waiting for their monthly benefits, an average of $227 per person. A default and extended impasse could also have major implications for the national economy, with federal spending cuts potentially triggering a downturn comparable to the Great Recession. According to Moody's Analytics, nearly 6 million jobs could be lost, stock prices could drop by one-third, and about $15 trillion in household wealth could evaporate. Okay, yep, that's about that one. And here's another one. A Texas man was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison on Friday for threatening to blow up an Amazon data center. Federal prosecutors announced, basically, he was a Trump supporter. Seth Penley, 28, had pleaded guilty in June to a malicious attempt to destroy a building with an explosive for threatening to blow up an Amazon Web Services center in Virginia. Penley admitted to disclosing a plan to blow up Amazon data center to a confidential source. In February, he told the source that a successful attack would kill off about 70% of the internet, according to a statement from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Texas. Back in March, Penley had met with an undercover FBI agent that was posing as an explosive supplier. Penley had told the person that the main objective is to fuck up the Amazon servers, the statement said. But Penley also said he hoped to anger the oligarchy enough to convince Americans to take action against what he thought was a dictatorship. During that conversation, Penley also claimed to have been present at the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Like I said, he was a Trump supporter, according to protesters and prosecutors, too. He claimed that he did not enter the building. I doubt that. But he went with a sawed-off AR rifle, which he left in his car. Penley was arrested back in April after meeting with the agent to pick up what he believed were explosives, but they were actually inert devices. A subsequent search of his home found an AR-15 receiver with a sawed-off shotgun barrel, a pistol painted to look like a toy gun, and flashcards related to the planned attack. Prereq Shaw, who is the acting U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Texas, said in a statement that the case shows that radicals are lurking on the internet, and they are far too often, and they move their plans off the web and into the real world. We are indebted to the FBI employee who put his life on the line to disrupt Penley's plot before he could inflict a real harm on data center workers, and we are proud of today's sentence. So he's getting 10. So this ignorant piece of shit is getting 10 years, which should have been life. Today's the last day of baseball season. The Cubs are not going anywhere this year. Hopefully they do better next year. The Seattle Mariners happen to be the surprise team in the aspect of how they're playing. So I guess we'll figure that out from there, how they go and how they do. What else do we got here? I'm looking for something that I was looking at. Let's see, there's a couple things here I gotta get to. Looking to see where I headed at. Here we go. Here it is. This was when the former squatter Donald Trump endorsed Harriet Hageman's primary challenge to Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney last month. He called her strong on crime and borders, powerfully supports the Second Amendment, loves our military and our vets, and will fight for election integrity and energy independence. The only thing that Trump didn't mention was the fact that that Hageman had been part of an effort to keep the squatter roll nomination from him at the 2016 Republican National Convention. Basically, she was against him running for squatter. As the New York Times reported earlier this year, Hageman back then had called Trump the weakest candidate and attributed his rise to Democrats who claimed she had voted in the Republican primaries. She condemned Trump as a bigoted candidate who would repel voters that Republicans needed to win the national election, warning that the GOP would be saddled with somebody who's racist and xenophobic, which is exactly what Trump is. What happened to that Harriet Hageman? Well, Trump cheated, not just cheated to win, not just the Republican nomination, but also the White House, and Hageman rapidly changed her tone and how she was before. Basically, she says, "I heard and believed the lies that Democrats and Liz Cheney's friends in the media were telling at the time, but that was ancient history." And she claims, "Oh, I quickly realized that their allegations against Trump were untrue." No, they were true. The thing that you believed to be lies were actually true. They were not lies. Hageman had told the Times about her past criticism of Trump. She claimed, oh, he was the best squatter in my lifetime. Actually, he was not. And basically, her dumbass decided to vote for him in 2020, even though he still lost, which was a good thing. And basically, she says that she's proud to strongly support him today. She technically should be embarrassed. Talk about the zeal of the converted. The truth is that Hageman didn't have some sort of epiphany about Trump, but instead, she, like so many other dumbass Republicans who expressed considerable doubt about the prospect of the billionaire of the failed billionaire businessman leading the party, simply caved to political expedience. The base of the GOP loved Trump's racism, and it became clear after he was elected that there was simply no political ground to be made up in opposing him on principle grounds. Just ask the former Arizona Senator Jeff Flake how that approach worked for his political career. And so Hageman, she's a dumbass and ambitious for squatting, had finished third in the 2018 Republican primary for governor, and threw her lot, all of it, in with Trump. But don't believe Hageman's flip-flop on Trump was politically motivated. Consider what she thought about Cheney, the woman that she is running to beat next year as recently as 2016. Back in 2016, Hageman had lavishly praised Cheney. Basically, she says, I know that Liz Cheney is a proven, courageous, constitutional conservative, someone who has the education, the background, and experience to fight effectively for Wyoming on the national stage. This is what Hageman had said at the time. And there have been and will continue to be concerted efforts to force true conservatives to sit down and shut up, which is what we always wanted Trump to do. We wanted Trump to shut up, but the fat ass never could. Those efforts have never worked on me, and I know that they would not work and have no effect on Liz Cheney. I am proud to introduce Liz Cheney as the next congressional representative from the great state of Wyoming. But what's changed in the intervening 5 years, you ask? What would so radically alter Hageman's views on Cheney? Certainly not the Congresswoman's conservative bona fides. Cheney currently has a 96% rating from Heritage Action, the conservative policy advocacy organization. Her lifetime score is 80%. According to VoteView, Cheney's voting record is more conservative than 74% of the House in the 117th Congressional District. And what changed is that Trump attacked Cheney because she laid blame for the January 6th insurrection at his feet and was one of 10 Republicans who voted to impeach him on that day. That split between Cheney and Trump created an opportunity, and Hageman, clearly an opportunist, leaped right at it. Even if it required her to wholly abandon, in the most transparent way possible, her best views on both Trump and Cheney, this is what Trumpism has wrought in the Republican Party, because the former squatter requires total, unquestioned loyalty, even though he shows none in return. The likes of Hageman are willing to do whatever it takes to win his support, even if it includes going back on everything you once said you believed in. Also, we got the murders that had been going on for years. This is a good one to even start with. This week, in response to the FBI's latest release of crime data showing the murders spiked across the country last year, many national news outlets published articles and opinion pieces suggesting the uptick was due in part to backlash over last summer's protests against crime violence, against the police violence, basically. There's a name for this line of thinking: the Ferguson effect. It's a criminological theory with a nasty half-life. After Michael Brown was brutally murdered by the Ferguson Police Department in 2014, law enforcement and criminologists falsely claimed that homicide rate increases could be attributed to the police withdrawing from their duties after receiving public criticism and policy backlash for the brutal murder. Years after the theory was debunked, the idea persists under different names: depolicing or police pullback. Apply some light scrutiny to this widely cited theory, and it quickly falls apart. The Ferguson effect and its successor theories consist of two main claims. First, the protests against police brutality caused police to stop doing their jobs, either because police are afraid of even the smallest forms of accountability for their violence, or because they are simply thin-skinned and mercurial. The latter is probably more true. More on this later. The second part of the theory states that when police stop doing their jobs, crime immediately begins to rise, and this is where the theory goes off the rails. It would be easy to prove that police pullback led to crime spikes if it were true. But study after study has disproved this notion. After Eric Garner was murdered by the New York Police Department in 2014, the NYPD responded to a wave of police brutality protest with a work slowdown. Unfortunately for the depolicing theory, the reported crime actually decreased during the slowdown and shortly afterward. New York City is no outlier either. Criminologist Richard Rosenfeld had published a definitive nationwide study debunking the theory in 2019 and has written multiple op-eds undermining it, signaling that he recognizes just how out of control the depolicing narrative has become. Another major problem with the depolicing narrative, aside from being wrong, is that it can easily turn into victim blaming. A recent Washington Post column highlighting the rise in murder sanctimoniously noted that attacking the police in the name of racial justice ends up harming the same people that police reform efforts intend to help. In other words, look what happens when you tell cops to stop killing you. More people end up fucking dead. But once again, this narrative doesn't hold water. Research shows that the Black Lives Matter protests successfully reduced the police violence, the very thing the protests aimed to prevent. There is, however, a tiny kernel of truth that's buried inside the concern over depolicing. It's likely that one of the largest protest movements in U.S. history led to an increased distrust of the police. The Democratic social scientists refer to this dynamic as police legitimacy, or lack thereof, which in turn can lead to a decrease in crime reporting and a decreased willingness to serve as a witness in homicide investigations. The theory was instrumental in the Obama administration's ineffective procedural justice reforms, which drew justified criticism. Merely changing perceptions of police without changing policing itself is more like counterinsurgency than meaningful change. Regardless, the police legitimacy theory has some empirical support. A recent working paper found that George Floyd's killing caused serious decline in the crime reporting across 8 cities, but that paper doesn't claim that protests caused the crime reporting decline. The truth of the matter is that policing makes people distrust the police, and if it's true that lower levels of trust in police cause crime, it's certainly an open question. Then police themselves would be to blame for the homicide spike and not defund advocates. One thing is fucking true. The protests in reaction to George Floyd's murder made police officers all over America throw tantrums in unison. In 2020, police went beyond the work slowdowns and acted out their retaliatory rage in the streets. Philadelphia cops tear gassed a crowd of protesters that were trapped in a highway. New York City cops arrested hundreds of protesters and even targeted legal observers. At least 8 people were blinded by non-lethal police projectiles in May of 2020. It's not a surprise that people don't trust cops after this. How is it possible that people who watch these tantrums on the news still could come away thinking that police should receive an enormous share of local public funds, wield weapons, enjoy legal immunity for their violence, and be entrusted with maintaining public safety? What other profession could behave like this and come away unscathed? Prosecutors, maybe. Police perceive calls to reduce their funding and the related protests as genuine threats to their power. This helps to explain why the depolicing theory gained traction in the first place. Linking the rising crime to police pullbacks provide a justification to maintain or increase police power and resources. It's designed to redirect the blame for gun violence from cops onto people protesting police violence. And notably, the term Ferguson Effect was itself invented by the St. Louis police chief in 2014, effectively a police public relations ploy. The theory also neatly reinforces the dominant narrative that police are the main cause of crime decline. De facto mayor-elect Eric Adams pushed this narrative in the New York Times Metro section during his campaign last year. It is politically useful for the pro-police advocates when the public safety conversation is reduced to defund protests that harm police morale, which makes us less safe. The depolicing frame allows the police preservationists to cast any criticism on the police, even the most milquetoast reform efforts, as an inherently dangerous project that will inevitably backfire and harm the marginalized communities who suffer most from the police and interpersonal violence. But here's the problem with this fucking line of thinking. It draws attention away from the important truths about interpersonal harm, like the fact that investing in low-income communities can reduce homicides, or the fact that gun violence is concentrated in deeply segregated neighborhoods. Now consider this. Could segregation persist without policing? But much of the violence is a result of police theories. It's structural. The continued neglect of communities is that they now suffer from the higher rates of gun violence. What abolitionist scholar Ruth Wilson Gilmore terms organized abandonment is the very same political process that sent hundreds of thousands of Americans to prison, and it diverted public funds away from welfare in favor of policing. In other words, the gun violence that black communities experience today is a result of the conscious political decisions, a decades or even centuries long effort to expose the black people to premature death. It is no coincidence that the Ferguson effect returned to the national spotlight right as police abolition enjoyed what might have been in the first moment in the sunlight over its generations long history. And in response to a disciplined organizing against police power, the police preservationists weaponized a pseudo-scientific form of victim blaming that portrays all interpersonal violence as a necessary result of the police inaction, of lack of capacity. Meanwhile, police enjoy the highest level of financial support, staffing, and technology in American history, which tells us that 2020's homicide spike is unequivocally a result of that status quo. The saddest part of this fucking story is how quickly the depolicing narrative strategy succeeded. For a brief moment, the national news media showed Americans a disturbing truth about the routine function of violence in the police work. But before long, mainstream news outlets across the political spectrum drew attention away from the horrors of police violence by claiming that resistance to police brutality caused depolicing and the homicide spike to go up along with it. It will take years for researchers to understand the many causes of last year's uptick in homicides. An unprecedented pandemic that shattered American society for months, a breakdown in the social safety net, and an increase in gun purchases, public alienation following police brutality, and so on. In the meantime, we should all fucking feel confident in calling the Ferguson effect and its newer iterations what they are, fucking propaganda. Let's see what else we got here. There's been talks about a fourth stimulus check, but I don't know if that's going to go out. Speaking more on murders, this happened about a week ago, or almost 2 weeks ago, but because I haven't been posting on my podcast in almost 3 weeks, this is going to be about almost 2 weeks behind. The former dumbass blonde bimbo that worked alongside Trump as the press secretary, Kayleigh McEnema, had tried to blame Biden for the spike in murders, but the year that she quoted, basically that happened under Trump. Former White House press secretary turned faux news host Kayleigh McEnema attempted to slam President Biden on Twitter Thursday by using a graphic that showed a significant uptick in the U.S. murder rate during the 2020 calendar year. There was only one fucking problem: Donald Trump was squatter during that entire year, not Biden. In the initial tweet sent out early Thursday morning by McEnema during that week, she quote tweeted Axios reporter Lachlan Markey, who had featured a New York Times graphic depicting a 20% plus increase in the number of murders that happened in 2020. Despite the obvious time discrepancy, she wrote, "The U.S. murder rate under Joe Biden." Shortly after numerous Twitter users pointed out her error, the tweet was eventually removed and deleted. The data in question originates from the FBI's Uniform Crime Report, which outlines the uptick in the number of murders that happened in the United States, highlighting a significant surge in 2020. The New York Times reports this: "The United States in 2020 experienced the biggest rise in murder since the start of the national record keeping back in 1960. According to data that was gathered by the FBI for its annual report on crime, the Uniform Crime Report will stand as the official word an unusually grim year detailing a rise in murder of around 29%. The previous largest one-year change was a 12% increase in 1968. The national rate of murders per 100,000 still remains about one-third below the rate in the early 1990s. The data is scheduled to be released on Monday, Which, this was, like, from last week, like, the last week, which would have been the 30th, with the news release, but it was published early on the FBI's Crime Data Explorer website. But on Thursday afternoon, McEnema tried again, quote tweeting the graphic and shifting the blame more generally onto Democrats, some of whom are proponents of reallocating resources away from the police departments. Her tweet said this: "Sadly, I was right. Biden enabled this. Defund the Democrats, mayors, you own this. We need to defund any Republicans." From the White House podium in August of 2020, she said, "I warned defund would result in rising crime. Sadly, I was right. She claimed that Biden enabled this. No, Trump enabled this. So try again, you dumb bimbo bitch." I started reading Les Miserables about a week ago, almost 2 weeks ago, and it's taken me almost 2 weeks to get to 100 pages, and the reason why is because the book is so long, and it's going to take me at least a year to read that fucking book. But I got up to, like, page, like, 100, and that's where I'm at right now. When I was shopping at Meijer, and not only did I pick up the two books, I talked to one of the guys I used to work with. His name was Nick. Yesterday was his last day at Meijer, so he's leaving. And a lot of people are leaving Meijer because they don't want to work for a certain asshole that works there. So basically this guy Nick is leaving because he got another job offer. He's still going to be in the same town where I'm at, but he's going to go work for Sam's Club. That's what he got hired in as. But he claims that Sam's Club was hiring for $15 an hour. I wouldn't know that for sure unless I applied. Then there's no guarantee that they're giving $15 an hour, but if he says they are, they might be. There have been rumors about that anyway. They were talking about raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, but it should be higher than that. Trump claims that Trump basically had lied the other day and claimed that he'd done more for the Christian community than anybody, and no, he hasn't. And Trump's not even a Christian anyway. He doesn't even read the Bible, he doesn't even go to church, so, and he does everything against what the Bible tells him to do. And also, because Trump is pissed that they took his Twitter account away, he's trying to get back on. But that's about all for today, to talk about. I guess I'll be back next week, to basically do another podcast episode. My next day off won't be until Thursday, so that might be about 5 days from now. So I might put up a podcast episode then. And I hope you guys enjoyed. And this is episode 72.